Aussie Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray. Sponsored by Verizon Business Security Solutions, powered by Cybertrust.
Hello and welcome to this special format edition of Risky Business, your weekly security briefing. I'm on holidays at the moment, so we're running short format shows with no headlines. And this week there's no sponsor interview with Verizon Business Security Solutions either. But don't worry, today's podcast is a cracker. This week's show is a panel interview I recorded at Microsoft's TechEd conference on the Gold Coast back in August. We started off by tackling the issue of mobile security, PDA and laptop, before the whole thing turned into a bit of a gabfest, but an interesting gabfest nonetheless. In attendance was Steve Riley, Microsoft's senior security strategist from the company's Trustworthy Computer Group in the United States, and Peter Watson, the chief security advisor from Microsoft Australia. And finally, Andrew Mann, a software architect for Anthem Software, a developer of mobile applications. Steve, I guess I'd ask you first. There seems to be a lot of hype around mobile security. People seem very concerned about it. Do you think it really is as much of a concern as we're being led to believe it is?
People want to be able to do their job anywhere they are. They want to be able to carry whatever the data they need to do that job. And that requires a certain level of security, a certain level of privacy that we can put on the device. But if you want to get an idea of just how much that you should worry, take a cruise by a website called the Privacy Rights Clearinghouse. They've been tracking data privacy breaches since January of 2005, and they've recorded 155 million lost records. And that's mostly been from mobile devices, whether it's a phone or a smartphone or a laptop or whatever, that has gotten lost or stolen, and the data has been breached because of that. So, yeah, I think it's something really important that we need to worry about.
Well, I guess we should define mobile devices, because prior, just before we got going here, I had a bit of a chat to Andrew Mann, who is a software architect, or aka a developer for Anthem Software, who does a lot of coding for mobile devices. Now, Andrew, you were saying that, you know, people are really carrying around a lot of sensitive information on laptops to begin with. So, you know, really, where would you define the mobile device?
Well, really, it's any portable device that you use to do your work, as we've said before. But as I was saying before, we've always been mobile in our work. It's just been the format of that data. And traditionally, we're replacing paper. And there's a lot of paper floating around in businesses, and we often fax is probably the best form of that. And how secure is that? And are we really benchmarking it against and being overly concerned about that?
Because it seems there's all this concern over people using PDAs and applications on PDAs, whereas, you know, we've really been carrying around Road Warrior stuff on laptops for, you know,
a long time. Yes, that's right.
Also, Andrew, just before you continue, for our listeners who might not be aware of what it is that Anthem Software does, could you just explain that?
Yeah, sure. We are a mobile software development company, and we've developed a mobile solution. It's a workflow solution, basically designed to replace the things that we do now with paper, and that is any company with a field team that are out in the field away from the office, and they basically need to connect back to the office to the information that they need to perform their daily activities. And we've basically developed a solution that sits on top of Outlook, Microsoft Outlook, which is a very familiar application for many office users today. And basically we just allow them to define their activities and how they want those activities to be performed. An example would be a plumber doing a job, so that's their activity as a job. Another example might be a mobile sales rep doing a sales order out in the field, visiting customers and so forth, so he's doing appointments and sales orders.
So how mindful of security have you guys been when porting this stuff over to handheld devices?
Oh, we've got to be very, very mindful of that, because you are putting sensitive data, what companies consider very sensitive data, onto mobile devices. So things like customer lists and inventory lists, cost prices, sell prices and stuff like that. And they don't want that to get in the hands of their competitors. So, yeah, we have to be very mindful of it.
So do you find that there's a lot of I mean, you take something like web applications, right, which is also another hot topic in security at the moment. You've got no end of, you know, web portals. There's OWASP for web applications. There's no end of resources out there for people who want to design secure scripted applications. Do you find there's the same level of support out there for people who are developing applications for mobile devices?
Yeah, definitely. The Microsoft Compact Framework has got a lot of security stuff built in. The Microsoft SQL Server Compact Edition database that we use, there's a lot of security stuff available, and a certain minimum amount that we do in our applications, and it's just a matter of sitting down with the customers to find out how important security is for them and give them their options and let them basically define how what level you go to when you secure a device.
Now, I'll ask Peter Watson, of course, who is the Chief Security Advisor for Microsoft here in Australia. What's Microsoft doing to really encourage its developers out there to adhere to secure coding practices? Is that something that you're actively pushing?
Absolutely. I mean, we've got a number of programs that we're doing, and that covers everything from, you know, working with organisations one-on-one directly, so those people who've got large development shops, we're taking them through, you know, what our secure development lifecycle is, actually making them aware of what are the processes, because whether it's actually on a traditional, you know, platform that you're actually developing those applications, or whether it is web-based application.
Peter, how receptive have developers of mobile devices been to efforts by companies like Microsoft to encourage them to really get schooled up?
Extremely receptive. I think we're seeing definitely a major shift in the market from what was a couple of years ago. You know, sort of, I think people were sort of a little bit interested in it, but now it's definitely taken off. And I think it's not just, you know, you were asking the question before about devices, you know, what is a mobile environment? I more look at it in terms of mobile data, because I actually think that's the real driver. If you look at it, most people who use PCs use more than one PC. They use their PC at work, they use their PC at home, they also might have a PDA. They're moving their data across those different platforms. So the requirement is actually, how do you protect that data when it's actually moving across all those different devices? So what we're seeing people are actually looking at is when they're developing the applications, or when they're actually looking at the environment, they're looking at, how do I make sure that data is actually secure, when it's, whether it's on the work PC, whether that's a laptop, whether that's a desktop, when it's the person accessing it from home, or might be using, you know, a web application coming through a kiosk, or when they're actually sitting on the PDA. So I think that's why you're seeing the drive, that everybody's now starting to take the interest in this, and the business is actually driving that, because everybody's saying, whether it's an individual saying, I want to be able to work from home, I want to be able to work from, you know, the airline lounge, I want to be able to work from a hotel, that's what's actually driving it. It's not, I wouldn't say necessarily that's the devices, I'd say it's actually the mobility of the data that's actually driving it.
Steve, you mentioned before that there'd been, you know, some astronomical number of records compromised, you know, since 2005, according to that website that you mentioned. I suppose there's some state laws in the United States which mean people have to disclose when some records have been potentially compromised. A lot of that would have been laptops left in the back of taxis. They wind up at some, you know, the dude who found them takes them to his cousin who knows how to format the drive. You know, the records are gone, it's not the end of the world. But I suppose that's the reason that you guys have brought in technologies like BitLocker into Vista, I mean, for full disk encryption. Was that really the driver there?
Absolutely. Yeah. There are two simultaneous...
We're a drinking culture here too, so it happens a lot.
Yes. Yeah. I've been made aware of this fact. There are two simultaneous drivers for the BitLocker technology. One was providing a mechanism that's easier to use than EFS. EFS is great, but it requires you to remember to use it.
Also with EFS, I mean, when you're using applications like Word and Excel, you know, all of those Office applications, they have a tendency of splattering all of your sensitive data into temp directories as well. So.
Right, and to solve that problem, we've recently released a toolkit that helps people know where to apply EFS so you don't have to think about it so much.
Mm.
But really what we found is customers were saying, give us something that we don't have to think about, something that protects all of the data on the hard drive. And, oh, by the way, how about something that protects the operating system itself, too?
Mm.
And that's the other big advantage that BitLocker has that EFS doesn't, is EFS only encrypts your data.
So you're worried that someone might be able to go in and replace a DLL with some Trojan code,
Exactly, yeah. Right? If you've encrypted the entire volume, you're protecting the operating system from offline attacks. You're protecting the data from offline attacks. You get a much broader set of protections that's actually something that's easier to control. The end users don't even see it. You don't interact with it. It's handled administratively.
I'd imagine people are kind of reluctant to do full volume encryption because they worry that, you know, if something goes wrong with it, then they can kiss their data goodbye. You know?
Right, but understand that you're talking multiple levels of physical protection of those bits, right? There's the logic in the controller board on the hard drive itself that helps ensure that the bits get recorded in the proper order. There's the file system, NTFS, that has mechanisms built in to check to make sure that the data that got recorded is actually the data that should have been recorded. You could theoretically think that those problems existed way back in the days of EFS, and actually we never got any reported problems that EFS was damaging files. So we don't really expect for there to be a problem with BitLocker doing that either. I'll tell you where BitLocker has created a bit of concern among a certain customer segment of ours, and that's law enforcement. The bad guys are going to use BitLocker too. We just have to accept that, right? And the bad guys are going to encrypt whatever.
But come on,
I mean,
any bad guy worth half their salt is already using PGP. I mean, come on, you're talking about the really low-hanging fruit here.
Okay. Well, maybe there could be a debate over if something would entice you to be a criminal, whether you have a lot of intelligence there or not. But, yeah, the bad guys will use it, too. I have had a number of requests from people in law enforcement to provide them with the back door for BitLocker. There isn't one. It's not there. There is no NSA key. If somebody involved in forensics has to acquire a computer from someone under investigation and that computer has – the volume has been encrypted with BitLocker on there, there's we have nothing to give them.
Well, hang on. Where's your private key, though, with BitLocker?
It can be in a number of places. It can either be in a TPM chip, which is stored on the motherboard.
And that would be the hardest thing to break. Right?
No, the hardest thing to break is if the private key is stored in the brain of the human who owns the computer. Mm. We can store the key either entirely in the TPM chip, or we can store it partially in the TPM chip and partially in a USB key.
Smart card?
Fully in not yet. Mm. Fully in a USB drive, or it can be a PIN. Oh, so we'll get a little bit deeper in how that particular one works, because I actually like that one the best. My favorite combination is a PIN plus a TPM chip. When, let's say you enable that. BitLocker, very, very early in the operating system, while it's loading, will stop and ask you for the PIN. This happens before the keyboard driver loads. So the only keys that work are the actual function keys. We did some pretty interesting research. What would be the strongest key to use for that, that a human could easily remember? And we documented this on the BitLocker blog. And it turns out that a seven-character key, you know, seven keystrokes, where four of them, at least four of them are unique, and at least two of them are repeated, create something that would take on the order of millions of years to brute force attack. So combine that with another secret in the TPM together to open the volume master key, which is then used to decrypt the data on the hard drive. And I think it's sufficiently strong against the kinds of attacks that we might see.
BitLocker is available in Vista, but which versions is it available in?
We've come up with different models of Vista because we see there's different capabilities that people want. But we really see, I mean, BitLocker is something that we really see, you know, the large enterprises of the organisations, or not just large, but it's really aimed at the corporate market that we see that has a requirement for protecting their information. But that doesn't mean to say over time you're not going to see other individuals such as consumers who are going to look at it as well.
Some consumer friends of mine have asked me about that. You can get the technology in the Enterprise Edition, the Ultimate Edition, and if you have Software Assurance, you can get it in the Business Edition as well.
Moving back onto development for a second, Andrew Mann, of course, from Anthem Software. Have you discovered any pitfalls while you've been developing code? I mean, do you actually have a process for having the security of your code for mobile devices? And we're talking about the PDAs. What are some of the dramas that you've had when dealing with the security of your code on sort of PDAs and whatnot?
Well, there's two factors in that. One is the transfer of the data from the office to the PDA. So typically the reason for having a mobile device is to actually be able to send data back and forwards in real time. So you've got to use the standard technologies that have been around for a long time now, which are available through the web, so it's things like SSL security. So they're not a problem. Storing the data on the PDA, that we just basically use encryption on SQL Server for the device as well. So
it's all built in.
It's all built in. That's right.
What about checking your code to make sure that you know, things like those, you know, security vulnerabilities like, you know, buffer overflow exploits and stuff that have been very common in mainstream computer code. Is there anywhere that you guys have been able to farm out, you know, like an audit or a check of your code?
Yes, you can. You can, when you get your code tested through VeriSign and those various organisations, you can do that.
Yeah, so they offer that kind of service, do they?
It is, but it's very limited. To be honest, we haven't taken full account of that yet.
So, yeah. Is that something that you guys all look at, though, do you think? I find it kind of hard to believe that someone's going to really, you know, target a GPRS-enabled device and try to hack it. And also the way the networks work here, it's a little bit difficult to find the addresses of various devices on that network. But most software vendors now, I mean, doing a security check for that sort of stuff for PC software is sort of a must. So I'm just wondering if it is a priority for the...
Not as much, no, because it's not like a server sitting there is all the time as a fixed IP and all that sort of stuff. It's a mobile device that goes up and down and gets different. And I don't think people are really going to target those at this point.
So really what it's about is protecting the data in transit and protecting it once it gets there. You're not so much worried about the hacking of a mobile device.
No, you're more concerned about, as you said before, device has been stolen. Mm. What do you do once it's been stolen? Well, we've got tools now that from the network you can basically disable that device and it just clears the hard drive. It's just gone. The data's gone. People trying to hack it. That's not a concern for us at the moment.
Steve Riley, do you foresee a time when, you know, digital miscreants will start actually attacking mobile devices like they attack, you know, PCs now?
Yes, I do. And actually, I think it's probably already starting to happen. I think about when I'm at home. I'm here in Australia now, so I don't keep my phone connected to the data network all of the time because the roaming charges would be astronomical. Mm. But when I'm home, this phone is essentially connected to at least three things all of the time. Yeah, it's connected to the Exchange server for my corporate mail. It's connected to my Hotmail for that. And I also leave the thing logged into Windows Messenger, right?
Mm, mm.
So.
Wow, you use a lot of Microsoft stuff.
I love it. It's good stuff. And it's built into the phone.
Okay.
Right? So because of that, mine is always connected. You had alluded to the fact that devices come up and go down.
Well, that's because you guys don't pay like $1,000 a megabyte for your data. You know, we do.
That's true. Yeah. When I'm domestic, it's unlimited for something like $14 or $24 a month. I don't remember. I do think that bad guys are going to look for avenues to try to break into these devices. Now, again, it's not because they want to hack the app. It's because they want to steal the data. We need to keep coming back to that. And I'm going to talk about that in the presentation an hour from now. You got to design your networks completely differently because now the bad guys are after your data. They're not after the network.
Well, I suppose they're only after certain data, though. I mean, obviously, the banking login credentials and, you know, logins to things like E-Trade, you know, trade portals, stuff like that, that's been the biggest driver that we've ever seen in the security community that has motivated people to actually start attacking devices. You know, how long do you think it'll be before we start seeing banks rolling out mobile banking directly to PDAs and cell phones?
It's already happening.
Is it? In the States?
Yeah, there's one project that I'm aware
of. Does that make you guys just shudder?
No.
But I mean, you know, if someone actually managed to hack into a mobile device the same way they'd hack, you know, through an IE vulnerability or something like that and drop some Trojan on there, drop a keylogger, mm-hmm. I mean, obviously that's going to be...
A screen recorder.
Yeah. Yeah, or a screen recorder. I mean, that's going to be a little bit of a concern. Yeah.
Let me give you an example of where something that you think isn't valuable might be valuable. As I said, this thing maintains a constant connection to my Exchange server, so my corporate mail is sitting on here. Mm. Of late, we have seen a rise in a certain kind of an attack called spear phishing. Spear phishing is...
Well, it's a very nice marketing term.
S-P-E-R, right?
Yeah.
It's an email you receive that looks in every way imaginable like it came from somebody on the inside, like it came from the internal security department or it came from the HR department. It didn't really... It's a really good forgery. Now, something that happens to people when they're reading their corporate mail, if they get an email from the security department and it's got all the right logos, the right colors, the right fonts, it looks internal, and maybe it says, we're doing some system maintenance and we require you to reply to this mail with your password. Everything looks okay, right?
Yeah.
So they'll reply, but literally they don't know their reply is going out. How do spear phishers know how to format internal mail? They do it by breaking into people's mailboxes and stealing internal mail that's already
That is interesting. This has brought us back into this whole argument around identity management, which is becoming, and it's not so much identity management, but authentication technologies are really, they're going to have to be our holy grail, aren't they? Because you're dealing with an inherently untrustworthy, I know you work for the Trustworthy Computing Group, so it's not...
The
solution's going to be...
The infrastructure is untrustworthy.
And the OS code. So I imagine that we're going to be really looking at being able to throw all of our personal information out there, like tax file numbers here or social security numbers in the States, put it all out in the open.
Those are already out in the open anyway. They can't be secrets anymore.
But as long as we can effectively authenticate our identity and that... and that we're the only one that can effectively authenticate ourselves through some sort of cryptographic, you know, mechanism, then it doesn't really matter if we're dealing with untrusted technology.
Well, so let me ask you this question. If we had an identity system that achieves what you said, and we have a mechanism for protecting the data, regardless of where the data lives, have we possibly then now come to the point where we don't care about the network or the device anymore, and we can begin to treat both of them as disposable items?
Mm, well, that's what I'm getting at.
Yeah.
Which is actually what
my next presentation is about.
Well, we've got a long way to go before we can get to that point, don't we, really?
Because
we are talking about rolling out standards.
Yes.
You know, and PKI has been around since the dawn of the ages, you know, and it's, you know, can you name one successful large-scale implementation of PKI, of 509? But, I mean, we haven't really seen wide-scale PKI work ever, and it's technology that's been around for 20 years, but this is what we're going to have to do if we want to shore up the security of our commerce. I mean, is that something you agree with?
Yep, and for too long, we've treated PKI as a project. You know, think about, like, you know, CIO Magazine, you know, comes out every month. It's for people who are higher level than all of us, right? Around a few years ago, around February or March, of every year, there'd be a declaration that this is the year of the PKI.
Yeah, yeah, I've seen that. I've probably written that one before.
And then around October or November of that same year, there would be a feature article of many customers whose PKI projects failed. Mm. And the reason is because they were having a PKI project. No one has a Kerberos project. No one has a UDP port 537 project, right?
Yeah.
To say that is silliness.
Yeah.
PKI is plumbing. That's what I think the P stands for.
Yeah.
It's plumbing like Kerberos is. It's plumbing like TCP and UDP ports. If you look at, well, okay, I'm going to trumpet the CA, I know. If you look at the Windows CA, especially in Server 2003, where it's all automatic, enrollment is automatic, you don't think about it, you turn it on, and it's done. Now, all of a sudden, there's a piece of plumbing that you can trust is there.
Yeah,
you know that every user, every machine has a certificate, and you can take advantage of that now.
Yeah, but I mean, I suppose if every machine has a certificate, yeah, great. But you've still got massive key management issues if you're going to have true public-private key you know, issues. I mean, one thing that I wonder is, you know, and maybe I'd like to get you know, Peter and Steve to both to comment on this, is I wonder if one day we're going to wind up with some sort of TPM chip on our mobile devices.
That would be my love, my
Yeah,
hope.
Well, that's what I think. I mean, it seems a logical fit. So now when I use my internet banking, I have SMS-based authentication on there, SMS-based two-factor authentication. The reason I prefer this to tokens is because it's out of band.
Yeah.
Like voice authentication or something like that. But it's still an insecure protocol, right? GSM is, I mean, look, not that it really matters. It's a pretty good process. But that's one bank solution. We've already got a situation here in Australia, I'm sure it's the same in the US, where people are carrying, you know, bags of tokens around with them, one for work, one for their eBay and PayPal account, one for their bank, one for this. I mean, so don't you think we've got a little bit of work to do on the device side to really enable PKI to be usable so that on their phone, when they go to a shop, they can maybe wipe their phone in front of some sort of scanner and a little window pops up and says, did you want to authorize a $25 transaction?
The challenge there is the source of authority for the identity.
Mm.
All right. Now, so you've actually gotten into something that's a bit of an interest of mine. A driver's license is issued by states, right?
So we're going to talk about federated ID, right?
Oh, okay.
Okay.
And that source of authority is trusted by liquor stores. I can go to a liquor store and I can buy liquor, not because I have a license from the liquor store, but because I have a license issued by a source of authority that the liquor store trusts.
Mm.
In my little bag over there, I have membership cards for Northwest Airlines, United, Singapore Airlines, Hilton Hotels, I mean, you know, all these things, right? Why do I have to have all these different things? I think principally it's a marketing issue. They want me to see their logo when I pull the card out of my bag.
Mm.
But it certainly would be easier to have a single card issued by some third-party source of authority that United, Northwest,
well,
Singapore, that they all trusted,
right? The reason I bring up the cell phone thing is a card can't tell you what you're authorizing.
That's
and this
right.
is one of the problems. Even though a smart card, you've got a key on there that can't come out, you could be opening a door with that thing or you could be buying a Miata. You know, you just don't know.
So there has been examples, Patrick, and there's a solution that we've been looking at that's been rolled out in some of the Nordic countries, and they actually call it WPKI. And so they actually have put digital certificates on SIM cards in actual mobile phones.
Mm.
And it uses some of the same principles that we've actually put in place for card space, so that you actually authenticate back to a server that actually has your credentials and your actual certificate. So some of the organisations in Australia, both in the finance sector and also the telecommunication sector, are looking at as a way of how can they use stronger authentication and actually using the mobile devices as a way of digitally signing transactions. So again, that is starting to happen. So your question about, you know, will we get to mobiles having a TPM chip? I definitely think there's people in the industry who are already starting to test some of those ideas.
How far out do you reckon we are?
Look, it's hard to say. As I said, you know, we're looking at what's happening with the Nordic countries, and they've definitely got a workable solution there that's actually up and running. They're using that in their financial sector at the moment, where they're digitally signing transactions using this solution. So there's people in Australia who are saying, hey, that's a, you know, as we've said in the Australian market, there are a lot of challenges on how do you get to that, you know, transactions.
So it's really less about locking down IE and more about locking down the transactions, isn't it?
Mm. Yep. Yeah. And yep. You know what? That's the only way we're going to stop phishing attacks.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, well, look, we're going to have to wrap it up, guys, because, you know, we've gone over time, but it's been a great discussion. So Steve Riley, once again, who's the Senior Security Strategist from Microsoft's Trustworthy Computing Group, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks a lot.
Peter Watson, Chief Security Advisor, Microsoft Australia.
Thanks, Patrick.
And Andrew Mann, of course, our developer here, our mobile systems developer, who is a software architect with Anthem Software. Thank you all very much for your time.
See you later.